And the American Dream is the secular version of that original American story taken from the Exodus story. And the American Dream carries the same dramatic form as the original explicitly religious story. But I argued that what the American Dream is that we're exhorted to shake free from the limits of the past, to engage in a struggling ascent, and if we have the courage to shake free from the limits of the past and engage in the struggling ascent, a gracious and open future is ours. Our efforts will be blessed and enveloped by the open doors of the future. The land is open and the society is open, and the doors will be there for those who really make the struggling ascent. And I argued then with, I thought, quite a few positive reverberations that many of us, perhaps the vast majority of us in a group like this, have very much participated in that dream of shaking free the limits of where our parents were, engaging through some discipline, self-initiation, hard work, postponement of pleasure, engaging in that struggling ascent, and that indeed the land was sweet and good. The doors opened, and our efforts were blessed, and we did well. As the immigrant ballot goes, when I first came to this land, I was not a wealthy man, but I did what I could. Built me a shack called Break My Back, and I did what I could, and the land was sweet and good. And that story goes on, and it's kind of a lifts up the immigrant experience, the lifting up the American dream. I said the dream plays a function, a religious function, for a people. Every people has a story. Every people has a dream. And that plays a specifically religious function. It gives structure and meaning to our experience. And I went through many concrete examples of that yesterday that I can't repeat today. And then the dream itself relates us to ever larger realities. Relates my experience, I'm very much part of the dream, relates my experience to my parents' experience who participated in that dream, to my grandparents' experience who came to this country as immigrants, and then their experience is related to the whole moving American stream of millions of people who came to this land and participated in that dream. And then I made the pushed the argument further that the values in that dream, the values of liberty or freedom from external restraint, the value of initiative, self-initiative, the value of natural opportunity lying in the natural openness of the land and of the society, are values that everyone ought to be able to participate in. So that the dream not only refers to the American experience, but the American experience itself is lifted up to a universal level. And we believe, as Americans, that the values of freedom, initiative, and opportunity are not just simply values of America, but they ought to be values for all, and that they're universal values. And finally, anchored in God's intentions for humankind to be free, to have initiative, to have natural, open opportunity. So that's a religious kind of quality to the American dream. And I believe that's very important. And I believe every people has to have some kind of story that operates indeed on a religious level for people. So when we're dealing with the American dream and the flag that symbolizes the dream, we're not just dealing with flat secular reality. We're dealing with something that has religious moment, religious importance to it. Well, that's kind of where I left it. I said the dream is open in the sense that everybody supplies their own content. For some of us, for some people, it was religious liberty and the religious ascent and the graciousness of this land to religious communities. For others, it was making a lot of money, adventure, sudden riches. For others, it was just getting away from poverty and making it and getting land and sons. In this country, For others, it was excellence. A whole range of different kinds of content put into that dream. Well, I believe that most of us participate in that dream, and it's a true dream for many of us. And if that were all the story, it would be indeed a simple thing, and indeed a beautiful thing, that is America. And one could not understand what indeed has happened to us in the last decade, or if one looks closely at American history, one couldn't understand many of the tragedies and evils of American history. We believe in the argument in our little book, I guess I showed it to most of you yesterday, published by Fortress Press. We believe that the last decade's been a very important decade for Americans, because that's the time in which what we call the dark side of the dream has been revealed in an inescapable historical way. Now, the dark side to the dream has always been witnessed to by the literary community in America. And while most of our early poets and literary people celebrated the bright side of the dream, and all of us learned those people in school, the Whitmans, the Longfellows, the Thoreaus, celebrating the optimism of the new start and the brightness of opportunity and initiative and liberty, that celebration was there in the majority of the artistic community. But meanwhile, underneath, there's kind of a subterranean current of people like Hawthorne and Melville, who are very sensitive to the tragic elements in American life. And an English professor that I was talking with about this dream told me that up until the Second World War, Hawthorne and Melville were really not taught in college English and college courses, because the pessimism and the sense of tragedy was there. The emphasis was on the optimism. But then there's a terrific reversal in this century, where the artistic community begins to bear witness almost solely to the dark side of the dream. And if you think of modern American artists, writers, dramatists, it's almost completely a witness to the dark side of the dream. A fascinating essay that we use in the book is by a fellow called Nelvin Voss, who wrote a little essay called The American Dream Turned Nightmare. And he documents how in the major contemporary American dramatists that there's a persisting theme that goes through them, and that is the American dream turned nightmare, and that the hope of the promise of land and sons is the major motif of American drama, modern American drama, and the nightmare is that the land is lost and the sons are lost. And it's just uncanny to lift up a few of these dramatists whom many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with. You take Arthur Miller and several of his dramas, but particularly Death of a Salesman, where Willie Loman is the salesman, very much a believer in the dream, and he hopes for his house in the country and that his sons will turn out to be fine people, and the house is lost, and his sons turn out to be ne'er-do-wells, and finally Willie commits suicide so that the land, in one last desperate effort to regain the land and to spur his sons onward. And you remember at the grave, Willie's neighbor says, Willie just had the wrong dreams. Well, that's just one dramatist. You can go through Tennessee Williams, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. Some of you remember that, where Big Daddy loses his land and his sons. It's a recurring motif that the land and the sons are lost. Well, that's the artistic witness, but we think that only hits a certain level of people, and only doesn't really grab at the heart of the nation. But we think that in the last decade we've experienced enough historical events that indeed the dark side of the American dream has been revealed in a terribly convincing way. And I'll just tick them off very quickly. And when you think of what we've gone through in the last decade, it's rather amazing that we've held together as a nation as we have. The civil rights movement became a militant black power movement, and then that scattered off into various kinds of factions. We had the student movement that began in the mid-60s, became very strident and militant, SDS, student revolutionary movements, which then splintered off into things like the Weathermen and the Symbionese Liberation Army, those kinds of things. We had the beginning of the ecological movement. In 1965, very, very few people even knew what the word ecology meant. And now we all know what ecology means. And the ominous import of some of the ecological judgments that are being made. We had the war, a war that was perhaps the most ambiguous in American history, and the peace movement that alienated so many young people from the American dream and from the American experience. We had urban unrest and riots in the cities burning. I'll never forget the shock. I was living in Moline. We had just moved to Moline, I believe it was in the summer of 65, and the great trails of smoke coming up from Watts in Los Angeles. What a shock. American cities are burning. The women's movement began in that time, and certainly the effects of that are not at an end by any means. And what else do I want to mention? We're not even talking about the most traumatic events of the assassinations. Kennedy's first, and then Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King in 68. I believe 68 was probably the most traumatic year, at least in my memory. The Democratic National Convention, the two assassinations. It was really a grim, grim kind of time. Well, you get the idea. The Native American movement, Red Power, all of these things coming to reveal to us that the American experience is not all sweetness and light. But most of us that have experienced the bright side of the American dream, that is not simply the whole story. So, Watergate, that's perhaps in some ways even the most traumatic. I think out of that whole revelation, the most discouraging thing to me, the most impactful thing to me was the revelation of the FBI harassing King the way they did. A lot of the left-wing people in the late 60s were telling about all these FBI and CIA shenanigans, and I didn't want to believe that, and I didn't believe it. I said, that's just conspiratorial theory of kooks over to the left wing, and now it's revealed that the FBI was very close to taking King's life. In fact, they suggested to him that he should commit suicide before taking the Nobel Prize, and threats revealing information about him. Reinhold Niebuhr once said, a nation can be called Christian only insofar as it does not kill its prophets. And we came dangerously close to officially killing our prophets in this last decade. Well, that's the dark side revealed in historical events in a way that we think can't be escaped by the American people. And we like to indicate how the dark side that has been revealed to us in a very powerful way is so closely related to the bright side. So, and we're, the interpretation here is flows from what we think the classical Christian interpretation of evil is. In the classical Christian tradition, evil is never an independent reality of its own. Evil always needs the good to feed upon. That's why evil can be so persuasive. It's so closely related to the good. Reinhold Niebuhr again said that the potential for evil grows right alongside the potential for good. So when you see something as great and powerful and good and alluring as the American dream that's meant so much to all of us, as a Christian one should be suspicious, or one should be wary that very goodness, that allure of the dream itself may have evil repercussions. May be very closely related to evil. And now I want to show you how I think the good and the evil is so closely related. In the last decade, in the revelation of the dark side, has revealed kind of the flip side of the goodness of the American dream. Our dream has lifted up that liberty, that freedom from the past, that dynamic movement forward with not caring for the past, not looking back, but moving on to the next task, constantly restlessly moving from the past into the future. And we've lifted up the liberty that frees us from the constraints of the past, social constraints, political constraints, all those things. Now, a dream like that, as powerful and meaningful as it's been, will tend, we believe, to leave great amounts of wreckage in the past. It restlessly moves onward and casts behind it wreckage, human wreckage, ecological wreckage, and very profound other kinds of wreckage that I'll get into. Let's look at this, because I believe it's very instructive and convincing. And yesterday we talked just briefly about the American Indian, or the Native American. I believe the American Indian has the dubious honor of being the first wreckage of the American dream. And in a very important symbolic way, shows us and reveals to us the evil side of the American dream. The American Indian, and why I say it's so symbolic and symbolically important, is the American Indian had quite a different story than the white settlers had. The American dream is a linear story. We begin somewhere, be free of something, and move on to something. Bigger, better, progression, upward. It's a story. It's beginning somewhere and ending somewhere. Now, most archaic peoples, we used to call them primitives, but we're a little less confident about calling anybody primitive anymore. Archaic peoples had a cyclical myth. That is, their lives and the meaning in their lives followed the round of the seasons. It was circular. The American Indian wasn't going anywhere. His religion, his culture, his style of life was based upon the seasons, upon the natural round, upon the cycle of life. And living in harmony, non-disruptive harmony with the natural round of things. And you can get this beautifully in the stories that have been collected by Neihardt, the American poet who collected many of the Indian stories. Beautiful spirituality in it too, but it's cyclical. And the American Indian living in harmony with the animals of the plains, with the natural environment. And here comes the American dream, like a great juggernaut across the plains, and we literally push the Indian off into poor lands. And then, very importantly, we render him invisible, that we shut them out of our minds. And not only that, we intentionally, through many different organs, take his story away from him. No longer can practice his religion and live out his cyclical story. And now when a people lose their story, they're in serious trouble. And then you get depression, alcoholism, lack of self image. And the American Indian, in a very powerful symbolic way, has been that wreckage of the American dream. First in losing his story, losing his lands, rendered invisible, pushed into the backwaters of American life. I grew up 20 miles from an Indian reservation in Nebraska, and I don't think, besides the times we played the Macy, that was the town, in football or basketball, I never saw an Indian. They never were around. You never thought about them. But there they were, off into this little tiny Winnebago reservation. So the Indian is the wreckage of the dream. Very powerful, symbolic group. The black, who were once indispensable to the dream as it moved forward, economically indispensable, forcibly brought here, and then became dispensable as the South moved on and as the American dream moved on, and they were rendered invisible. In fact, Richard Wright wrote a book called The Invisible Man, and one of the wrenching experiences of black people as they seem invisible to white people. And their experience and their achievements have been rendered invisible. And so they're pushed off into the backwaters of American life, not allowed to participate in the dream, and they become wreckage. They lose their story, too. That forcible bringing them here disrupted them from their story. And one of the great efforts of black people today is to try to recapture in some way their story and their roots. Well, we could go on ad infinitum here, and I believe the elderly are a good example of the wreckage of the dream. You see, this is a youthful, vigorous dream, dependent upon a lot of energy and aggressiveness. What happens when the engines slow down? Can't participate in that vigorous, youthful dream. Well, you're left behind. And there's a fascinating overlap of these groups of human wreckage in the cities. So that what you have in the central cities, you've got blacks, you've got Indians, you've got a lot of elderly people that can't leave the city because of economic stringency. They're left behind with the wreckage. And then you can add Latinos of various sorts to that, more recent immigrants. And the cities themselves become the wreckage of the dream. They were once the vehicle of the great movement forward of vast numbers of Americans. And it's an exciting story of Chicago, the waves of people going through. And it's, a lot of that's been documented beautifully. But now the Nordics are pretty well through. They're out in the suburbs. And the wreckage has inherited the city. And the city becomes wreckage. And the nation has a policy of benign neglect toward the city because the action is elsewhere. The dream has moved onward. The suburbs were the dream. And further out, now it's not only the suburbs, but a cabin in the country. And why think and dwell and worry about the city? Well, we could talk about Vietnam. We could talk about just plain consumer waste and how the wreckage of bad consumer practices kind of comes back to haunt us. Chris, were you going to say something?
Oh, I just said turn the black button.
Oh, turn the black. Which way? This way?
No. Yeah.
Oh. I'm writing up and down. I'm sorry. Okay, the wreckage. You wrecked me for a minute there. Now I got to go on. Well, all of those are very, very powerful. And I think what we've experienced in the 60s is that wreckage rising up. You see, you don't squash a people down without them having a rebound effect. It's the kind of image I like to think of as the jack in the box. You can put that lid on, consign them to the backwaters, but they're not going to stay there, and they're going to react with angry power, and that wreckage has surfaced in American life. Now there's another very subtle, but I think even in the long run, more profound kind of wreckage of the dream, and that's what I call structures of belonging. You see, all of the dream is dependent upon people coming from somewhere, some community that gives them identity, some basic social group that shapes you and nurtures you, gives you an identity, who you are, a place in life, roots. We were talking yesterday about that curious American relation to the sense of roots. Well, the dream is dependent upon that. We all need a launching platform, a family, a community, an ethnic group, a voluntary association, a church. But the dream has emphasized the ascent. Not the launching pad, not the nurturing groups that give us an identity. And as we accelerate the ascent and lift up liberty, freedom from constraint, I'm terribly fearful that those structures of belonging are being eroded. That the roots that we need for a sense of belonging are washed away as we lift up the dynamic elements of ascent and freedom from the past, I mean, after all, families are constraints. A lot of restraints upon you if you want to take seriously marriage and family life. And if you want to be responsible in the community, you can't be floating around all the time in that individual ascent upward and onward. And we're experiencing in many communities widespread rootlessness, people not having any roots and not caring about roots, not nurturing those communities of belonging. I interpret kind of the waves of nostalgia in American life as that longing for the roots that are being lost. A few years ago was the movies of the 20s, Bonnie and Clyde, that kind of stuff, and then the 30s, and now on TV it's up to the 50s. That's the great age when the world fit together and there was order and nostalgia about the 50s. My kids all know Fonzie, right? And they say, was it really that way in the olden days, Dad? in the 50s, and I didn't think that was very long ago. but thirsting for, and I would suspect Holden is an interesting, has an interesting role or element in that whole quest for roots. Many of us uprooted people, but coming back here with many of the people who share similar backgrounds, and there's a sense of belonging, a lot of likeness in us, and a lot of sense of affinity. If you're not from Minnesota, this generation, you were two generations ago, or some, or Illinois. I would suspect that part of the wreckage of the dream is that we're not nurturing those communities, those cohesive communities. It's very difficult to find cohesive communities in the cities anymore, the metropolitan areas. The dynamic and movement is too great. And what's that going to do to us as a people in the long run without those nurturing communities? I believe that's serious wreckage of the dream. Well, I've got to press on here. That's the dark side of this emphasis on shaking free from the limits of the past. The dark side is that the nurturing contexts of the past are not cared for and not nurtured themselves. Well, the dark side of this emphasis on initiative, struggling ascent, self-reliance, is that we have a terrible time dealing with people who can't or won't ascend. What do we do with those parts of our population who were rendered invisible, who became wreckage, who don't have the characteristics of self-initiation and discipline? We tend to think that those characteristics of self-initiative and discipline are just part of human nature, and that they're not trained into a people by those structures of belonging. And when they're not present in a people, we tend to fall back on racist interpretations. They're naturally inferior. They naturally can't discipline themselves. Indians and blacks and Latinos, they're naturally inferior to we who have those characteristics of self-initiation. So that's one side of this difficulty of understanding those who can't ascend. Yesterday we had some interesting conversations about the children of people who have made the sharp ascent. My grandparents came to this country and finally got a farm and finally survived northeastern Nebraska in a rather poor land. My parents left the farm and came to the small town and finally worked their way into a comfortable life in the small town. I've left the small town, gotten a graduate education, a PhD, and a professional class. What are my kids going to do? What's the ascent for them? Can they ascend? And the terrible uneasiness that we have, whether they can ascend further. And if they can't, if the dream says you ought to ascend, and the parents think you ought to ascend, what's going to happen when the kids can't? Or even worse, more disturbing, they won't. They say, I don't want to participate in that dream, that race. So, you know, that's difficult. And I believe our culture and we as a people who have been in the dream, the dark side of the dream is not knowing what to do and how to deal with those groups, those persons that can't or won't ascend and participate in that dream. And that's a darkness. That's the darkness of the dream. Well, finally, the dark side of that gracious open future is that because of the very success of the dream itself, so many persons making the ascent, so many corporate groups, businesses growing and making the ascent, that this future is not so simple and open and gracious as it once was. In fact, for many people, the future seems cluttered. And it seems complex. And it seems to be coming at us at great speed, in a bewildering kind of speed coming at us. So the doors are not opening naturally anymore. It's very complex to become an individual entrepreneur in our society. One has to join large groups, and that's even complex and cluttered. It's interdependent and bewildering, the future. We had a curious experience at the seminary. In recent years, most seminary graduates are pretty confident that there are opportunities in the church, jobs. The future's open, the land is sweet and good, the church is growing. Well, that hasn't been the case in recent years. And all kinds of dire predictions come from national headquarters that by 1980 there's going to be 800 too many pastors. And the future is not that open. The future is cluttered and crowded and complex. And so our junior students, first year students, 4 years from graduation, rose up in great anxiety and demanded of the dean that he give them a formal statement about how grades relate to their getting a call 4 years hence. They want to know if they got an A or a B, how that would affect their call possibilities 4 years from now. Now that's anxiety about the future. That's the feeling that it's cluttered and complex. And yesterday you shared some of your insights into what college-educated people are facing in some ways. The doors are closed. It's cluttered. It's complex. When you think of how difficult it is for a little business or a little organization to deal with the welter of regulations and demands, I'm glad I'm not a businessman. I don't know how they stand it, dealing with the complexity of the whole thing. Well, that's the dark side. And perhaps, at least I believe, there's been a pretty sharp decline in the optimistic spirit toward the future. Just from the generation that I was a part of, I never thought about real limitations, the future being closed. You know, there were so many opportunities, it seemed, and that isn't the way younger people feel today. The dark side is kind of closed in. Well, that's a revelation, I believe, of the dark side. Now, what does this mean? What does this mean? That the dream, the dark side of the dream, is being revealed to us as a people. Well, first of all, it means that we're in kind of a religious crisis. Our story, our dream, does not seem as persuasive and as true as it once was. And one very important thing that I think the Christian community has to contribute to America is to help Americans understand the crisis of their dream, and to give that crisis a level of meaning which is deeper than the dream itself can give. You see, because the dream has no way of dealing with fault and failure and evil. It's an optimistic dream, upward and onward and openness. The American dream doesn't have a way of dealing with fault and failure and evil. So I believe a very important role that the Christian community has to play is to interpret what's going on here. And I believe our interpretation of evil is very important for the American people to understand. What's happening, I believe, from a theological point of view, is that something that is very good and alluring, the values in the American dream, the dream itself, the values have been lifted up, partial goods, liberty, initiative, natural opportunity, partial goods have been lifted up to be the whole good. And that's idolatry. That's what idolatry is all about. Taking something good, that's obviously good and alluring, and making it your God. Assigning it too much importance. Negating the other side of the coin, so to say. Other values that are needed to complement the values that we hold so dear. So what I believe has happened is, because it's been so successful, paid off so well to all of us, we've been neglectful of the values on the other side of the coin. The values needed to complement liberty, initiative, and natural opportunity, and that the Lord of history himself is calling us to account. That is, our story fit in a youthful, young, open environment, and now we're being brought to the time when we're a mature nation. No longer youthful, the natural opportunities are no longer there. And the Lord of history is pressing in upon us to redefine ourselves and our story. That's what I think the deeper religious meaning of the American challenge is that we're being called to become mature as a nation and to redefine our story, to redefine ourselves. One very good biblical image I like to think of in this score is Jeremiah on the potter's wheel, you know, where he was called to go down to the potter's house and see the potter at work. And then Jeremiah brought that word to the people of Israel, that people of Israel, you're like the clay on the potter's wheel, and the Lord of history is shaping that clay. And there's a lot of grinding going on, and a lot of pain, a lot of suffering and cutting. But in that cutting, in that shaping, which is painful and pressure-laden, the Lord is working out for you, O Israel, a particular role in history. Now, I believe that's what's happening to us as Americans, that we are the clay on the potter's wheel. And the rest of the story in Isaiah is kind of shaking, because if the clay is resistant and the Lord does not like what is emerging, he squashes the clay down and starts over. He says, "Oh Israel, I can do that with you." And I believe that's the story of nations. They come with a story. Their story is inevitably idolatrous, becomes idolatrous. The pressures of history move in. The wreckage is revealed. The dark side is revealed. And if that nation does not turn in some way from its path and redefine itself, it will go like other nations and empires of history. So I believe we're in a crucial moment in our history when we are being put on the pressure point of God. We're being put on the potter's wheel as a people. That's why the crisis is not a superficial crisis. The crisis is finally a religious crisis of our own way of identifying ourselves as a people. So the pressure is on. America is being called to redefine herself and her story. And I believe Christians have a very important role to play in interpreting that crisis, and then in moving with the nation and helping to construct and resolve the crisis, which I want to get to now. Before I do that, I wanted to say that when the screws are turned, when the pressure point comes, when the potter begins to shape the clay and it begins to grind, responses to the crisis, to the pressure point, are heightened. And then you begin to see different crisis responses to the challenge. And I'd like to talk about, in shorthand term, the left, the response of the left and the right, and the middle, all of which we think are finally inadequate and need a deeper thinking through of our problem. The left, when the dark side is revealed, the left only sees the dark side. and only involves itself with the dark side, and the response is one of self-hatred, hatred of themselves as Americans, and a terrific obsession to go back and destroy everything in American history that looks like it was good. And we've all seen this, the dredging up of the most evil things, so that all the heroes are bloody. And it's an orgy of self-hatred of the American history, of the American experience, and an orgy of self-hatred about themselves. And so the left becomes masochistic and sees only the dark side. And that's only the only reality they see, the only reality they take seriously. And then they usually have proposals that are outlandish. We're going to jump completely out of our skins as a people and take up a whole new cultural story, a whole new political system, a whole new economic system. They have delusions about what is possible. So that's the left response to the challenge of the dream. Breaks down into a countercultural left and a political left. Countercultural left is not interested in political revolution. The countercultural left tries to set up communities with a new story, not with the dream anymore, but with, usually they go to an Eastern religious mentality or Native American, try to get back to the cyclical style of life. And that's the countercultural left. The political left, we all have seen at work. The Symbionese Liberation Army, who see nothing but the dark side and have wild proposals for revolution and the new world that's a-coming. So that's, and we think that kind of response is not attentive to the gifts and the values in the American dream itself, and has, usually, we can push the analysis to very refined levels, usually for the left, there's something very specific that's the source of evil. And if you get rid of that, you'll no longer have any troubles. A simplified version is usually a scapegoating that goes on. Somebody's to blame. If you get rid of that, things are going to be okay. The right is the party of denial. It's either the denial of the dark side, there really isn't any dark side. It's exaggerated. It's just the silly media dredging up the dark side all the time. And the dark side is very minimal in American life. So the denial that it's even there. Or that's one version of the right wing. And the other version is that it's just that people are failing to live up to the American dream. If everybody would live up to the American dream and participate in it more vigorously and fully, we wouldn't have any problems. And our argument is, indeed, you could invite everybody into the American dream and they could participate vigorously, and you might have more evil than you would have with some on the outside. Well, the center is most of us. And we're aware of the dark side. Don't try to deny it too much, although we don't like to existentialize it too much, really take it into us. We're certainly not many of us of the left. And the characteristic of the middle is that we hope through the grace of God that we'll muddle through. we know the ambiguity of the situation, how complex it is, but we're bewildered by it. And just kind of keep doing what you're doing and hoping that we'll muddle through without any deeper systematic thinking about our crisis. That's the problem with the middle. And it's interesting in the present presidential election whether the candidates are thinking deeply enough about the problems of America, or whether we're both going to wind up with two middle muddlers who both just want to do a little bit better what we've been doing. And perhaps what we need is a more profound and deeper rethinking of the challenge that's America.
Is all of this in your book?
Yeah.
Maybe we ought to send copies of your book
to
the presidential candidate.
Well, I'm afraid there aren't any real blueprints for them, but
turn over to me.
Might be.
Well,
I'll autograph you for Jimmy Carter. Well, let's spend a few minutes on the constructive side. It's fun to analyze. There's a certain kind of illuminative power that comes with that. But what is it then that we're called as a Christian people to do in relation to this American dream, which is a part of us? You see, we're not dialoguing with something out there, with those people out there. We're, first of all, carrying on a conversation with ourselves, because we're part of the American dream. And we participate in the bright side, we participate in the dark side. So first of all, it would seem to me Christians have to be honest about that, that that's part of their culture, that they're not free of it, that they're in it, and that they better fess up to that. Okay, then it seems to me the second very important task is to begin to sort out those elements that are part of the American dream and those elements that come directly from the Christian tradition. So we have to be clear about our own story, the Christian story. And that's why I think Holden, biblical study, continuing education for all members of the church is extremely important. You see, because we all participate in the civil religion and we participate in the Christian tradition. And it's very important, I think, for Christians to do some serious thought about which is which, because we participate in both. So we have to be clear about our own story, and then we have to carry on the dialogue with the American dream, to carry on the constructive side. Where do we go from here? And as I said before, I think one of the most important things we can do is to contribute our notion of evil and wrath and the demonic to the nation. Because the nation, from its own story, has no way of dealing with that. No way of dealing with evil and fault and wrath. And perhaps one of the most instructive points or examples of that biblical insight being brought to the nation is Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural address. In the midst of the Civil War, he brought to the people an interpretation directly from the Bible, an interpretation of what was going on, and an interpretation that took seriously evil. It also took seriously the ambiguity of the problem. Remember, he says that both sides pray to the same God. And who knows God's will, but each side decides for themselves their perceptions of God's will. And then he ends with that notion, not ends with it, talks about the wrath that's going to come from this terrible blight of slavery. The wrath of the fathers being visited upon the third and the fourth and the fifth generations, and that wrath falling on people who don't deserve it. But the wrath of God, when the structure of human life has been violated that badly, you're going to get repercussions throughout history, and the wrathfulness, the judgment is going to be visited upon people who don't deserve it. And then he ends, you know, with that charity toward all, no vindictiveness, that powerful statement of the evil, interpretation of the evil that was befalling the nation. And that's what we need, perhaps, today, to interpret the last decade to the American people, to interpret particularly the Vietnamese War to the American people. And we have no one that has come forward with that profound biblical interpretation of evil and wrath. It helps me to understand my plight every day in Chicago when I think of the Christian doctrine of evil and wrath. We're surrounded on the south side, on three sides, by very poor black ghettos. And sometimes that's not very comfortable. Each day I pay in some way, and my children pay in some way, for the sins of generations ago. And that wrath and judgment is falling upon me. And it helps me to understand that I'm responsible for redressing those evils of the past. But it also helps me to understand in a very profoundly Christian way that that wrath will not be overcome without the suffering of the agents of God within that situation. So that the Christian role is to take on that suffering, that comes from generations past, and to take that into the oneself in the healing process. There's no healing without suffering. No healing without that wrath being confronted directly. You see, in the American dream has no way of grabbing a hold of that. But the Christian story does. So one of the most important contributions is to understand what's happening to us. Understand the evil and the wrath. Okay, let's move on from there to the constructive side. And I want to do just a couple of things before we have to break. Let's put up those values that are so powerful and cherished in the American dream. Liberty, initiative, self-reliance, those virtues, and natural opportunity. Lying in the openness of the land and of the society. Those are the values that have been lifted up so powerfully by the dream and borne forward, and we value them and cherish them, and we ought to cherish them. However, we believe, and I've already argued this to some extent, that the dark side is simply the emergence of the suppressed values that lie complementary to liberty and initiative and natural opportunity, that we've repressed and negated other values that are absolutely important in order for these to go on. We've idolized these values, and we're beginning, and by idolizing them and neglecting the complementary values, we're experiencing a lot of pain and suffering as a nation. Now let me show you concretely what I mean. I think liberty and belonging are complementary, that you can't have one without the other. And what we're getting, and the wrath we're getting in American life, is trying to get on along without freedom, without belonging. And let's draw that out a little. Belonging is some sense of covenant with a spouse, with a family, with a voluntary association like the church, with a community, with a country. That's what it means to belong, to be part of it, to have some implicit promises, sometimes explicit promises, made by them to you, and you to them. And it gives a cohesiveness to things that really is absolutely important for liberty. Because the structures of belonging and the covenant, the promises, the promise-making communities that make up the structures of belonging, give persons what I like to call an internal moral compass. Give them a structure, a moral sense of what is permissible, what isn't, what's tasteful, what isn't, what's moral, what isn't, what is within the realm of promise keeping and what isn't. And when a nation begins to lose the internal moral compass in a people, it won't be long before it loses liberty, you see. Because if we've got structures of belonging that give us that internal restraint, internal sense of moral guidance, then you can have freedom, can't you? You don't need a lot of external controls. People govern themselves. And that's what self-government's all about. First of all, there's an internal sense of responsibility and moral government, and that allows a people to be free. If people are bereft of that internal moral covenant, all they have is a naked drive for their own pleasure, a naked drive for their own self-interest, we won't have liberty for very long. There'll be chaos. Everybody will be going after their own thing without any care for anything else. More and more external restraints will be put on us. The government can't allow chaotic self-interest just bubbling up all over. We'll lose our freedoms. So belonging and liberty are absolutely essential for each other. And the dream has lifted up liberty, but not belonging. And the church has an extremely important role in nurturing the sense of belonging and internal moral compass, the sense of covenant. And we begin with the marriage covenant. What does it mean to make those promises? Family covenant. What does it mean to love within that context, the covenant with our churches, the covenant with our neighborhoods, the covenant with our nation that we face every time we sit down and write out our tax returns. You see, if there's no longer any internal sense of fairness about writing up your tax return, pretty soon the government will have so many bugs on us that we won't be able to cheat. You see, the covenant, the sense of covenant, the sense of belonging, of making promises. And I believe the church and the Christian faith is absolutely essential in the long-range health of the nation, in the mission to maintain our freedoms. And we can't have freedom without the belonging. I'm conscious of running up against the time limits. We've got the challenge of interdependence over independence, cooperation over against self-reliance, and over here we've got the challenge of intentional justice. And we're, as a nation, experiencing a lot of pain and struggle on that score now. How do you redress historic injustice? Affirmative action programs, quota systems, the debate goes on, busing, demands that certain percentages of police force be minorities, percentages of women and this and that. See, we're beginning to struggle with the question of intentional justice. We've gone along for centuries on natural opportunity, just thinking it's there naturally. Now we're to the point where the future is complex and interdependent enough that we have to decide what doors we're going to open and for whom. That's a new story for Americans, a new challenge for us. And it's painful to sort that through and to work through that. And I believe, again, the church has a very important role in insisting on intentional justice and entering into the debate. I'm not saying there's any blueprints about the way that comes off, but to take the challenge seriously. Well, just let me say one more paragraph. This, I believe, is the task of the church on the level of values. Lifting up the neglected values of belonging and moral nurture, the neglected values of interdependence and cooperation, and the neglected values of intentional justice. And all of us as Christians have to think seriously about that. And I believe the church has an important role in lifting up each one of those values, very practically and concretely. The final part that I just can mention in passing is the dialogue and conversation that has to go on between the Christian faith and the American civil religion on specifically religious doctrines, like the doctrine of sacrifice. You see, the American dream does have a notion of sacrifice, but it's what we call athletic sacrifice. It's disciplining the body for the sake of succeeding, for the sake of winning the race. And there is a notion of sacrifice in that struggling ascent. But we believe that the Christian notion of sacrifice is very, very different and has a lot to do with the question of wrath and evil that the American dream does not understand. And I got into it a little bit before, but I believe a profound understanding of evil and wrath leads up to the Christian notion of sacrifice, because the life of intentional sacrificial love that the Christian community calls forth is that occasion that God uses to overcome the wrath, to overcome the alienation and separation in the nation, in the community, in the family, in the marriage. And I'm fully convinced that without the leaven, without the salt of the Christian community's commitment to suffering love, that those covenanted communities will never arise, or they'll fall upon, they'll disintegrate very quickly. That the wrath in our nation and the alienation in our nation will not be overcome without the suffering that takes into itself that wrath, that undeserved wrath. And we could use very many examples about how this works. Martin Luther King is a very good example for me of a Christian notion of sacrifice working within the American dream. And I like to think of you know, the gap being there between the blacks and the whites, just no doubt about the injustice in that situation. And anybody that has lived close to the black community knows that there's alienation and separation there. And there's wrath involved in that. There's anger on the part of the blacks for whites, and there's on the part of whites there's distrust for blacks and fear of blacks, and there's real separation. There's been injustice. And King came along as a Christian prophet, I believe, a Christian committed to suffering love, and placed himself right in that no man's land between the alienated communities. And it's very interesting how King operated. He would not let the whites off the hook. He pressed the legitimate demands of the blacks and alienated, made the whites angry. On the other hand, the blacks, a significant part of the black community, wanted to demonize the whites, the white devils. They're the source of all evil, and to destroy them. And King resisted that part of the black community. We tend to forget that when he died in 1968, a large part of young black militants rejected King flat outright. So King places himself in a cruciform kind of way between those warring parties, refusing to demonize the whites, refusing to not to press the demands of the blacks, and got himself caught in that no man's land, and took in upon himself the wrath of both communities, and suffered in a very intentional mission in his life, suffered in that no man's land, and took in upon himself a lot of that wrath. And finally the wrath killed him. And he knew that. He knew it was going to kill him. But he did it anyway. And I believe out of this suffering love and that prophetic figure, and in many, many other people who placed themselves within that no man's land, God used that occasion for overcoming the wrath and alienation in our land, in our communities, within our families.